Conclusion. Everything in life necessitates cooperation. Breathing itself is an act of cooperation with nature. Great works of genius require the work of many, those who make the tools used in creativity, a general foundation of awareness from which the individual can soar, the inspiration of others' thoughts, an appreciative audience. Would Leonardo have produced his masterpieces had no one been interested in his work? Would Jesus Christ, self-complete and perfect, have given outer expression to his wisdom had no one cared to hear him? Jesus himself said, "Cast not your pearls before swine." A need must exist before it can be addressed. Cooperation of many kinds is essential to life itself. Without it, there would be only one hand flapping, but no answering clap. Cooperation within intentional communities can lead to madness, however, if it isn't based on a desire to cooperate with wisdom, at least to the extent that its members understand the concept. I have tried in these pages to present the principles out of which Ananda grew and has flourished. I admit that my first expectation was that I'd tell more of Ananda's actual story, to bring it up to date with anecdotes, and to explain the lessons we learned from our tests, adventures, and interesting or amusing episodes. Fortunately, these events were mostly a proving ground for the teachings of our guru, Paramhansa Yogananda. I say, therefore, that apart from the blessing he bestowed on the concept itself, he is in fact the patron saint of modern communities. His frequent intervention in times of need, though subtle, has been repeatedly a lifesaver for us. Instead of writing the anecdotes that make up Ananda's history, what I have done is leave you, oh, poor reader, stranded on a beach. The launching of the ship, Ananda, to which I thought I was inviting you, has been delayed. By 1970, the point to which this story has taken us, the ship was still unfinished. Many events followed, some of them dramatic. In fact, I wonder whether the story can ever be told fully. In March of the year 1970, I received a second threat of foreclosure, this one from the trustees for Ananda Farm. On the last possible day, May 30th, I was able to send the check in the mail. 1 month later, on the 4th of July, Independence Day of all dates, our temple burned down. This proved, in fact, to be a blessing, for rebuilding it provided a means for uniting the community in a common purpose. Again and again, miracles saved us, like the day our carpenters, constructing the publications building, which has been renamed since then Hansa Mandir, were saved from disaster. The roof had an unusual design, which the men couldn't carry to completion. Extensive research hadn't provided a solution for its construction. The men were literally leaving the job when a car drove up and a man stepped out of it. "I've come from Santa Barbara today, 500 miles, he announced. "My purpose in coming was to ask if there's anything I can do to help you." Hope glimmered faintly. The men explained their predicament. Whereupon the visitor, Bond Darnell, exclaimed, "Why, I'm probably the only builder in California who knows just the technique you need for this job. It's something I learned in Canada, brought over from the Orient." With this help, the roof was completed. We were blessed with tests also, like the forest fire I've mentioned already, and the pluck that helped us persist in the face of seeming defeat. Jyotish, turning to his wife, Devi, who 10 days earlier had given birth to their only child, and saying, "Well, at least this fire solves the problem we've been having with leaks." I could go on and on. Indeed, I expected to do so. What a lot remains to be told. and I'd have enjoyed the telling of it. Such a book, however, might easily run to more than 1,000 pages, far too long and counterproductive to its real purpose. Indeed, the story has already been told by the explanations I've given of the principles on which Ananda was founded. Those principles tell who we are, what Ananda is, and why the whole experiment has turned out so successfully. I hope I've shown convincingly why my belief in cooperative communities is very deep. To me, they are an essential solution to the problems of civilization at this stage of history. Small, clearly thought out, consciously lived experiments are needed as a way of working out the challenge before humanity, how to preserve human values under the onslaught of technology. I've explained basic attitudes without which I think no community can succeed. What would follow the telling would be only details. A plethora of them might cause the reader to lose sight of more important points. I built Ananda on principles I'd learned through meditating on the life of Paramhansa Yogananda. After years of working with people as head of the Monks in Self-Realization Fellowship and as the director of SRF Center activities throughout the world, as the victim of ongoing attempts to suppress and then ruin me, and as a consequence of having to deal with people's indifference to interests other than their own. One of the things I learned was the relative importance of cheerful, willing cooperation compared to blind obedience. At Ananda, I delegated responsibility to others as much as I could. I did so partly because it takes the energy of many people to create a work of which the goal is to benefit people. Partly, too, I did so because I recognized that others were blessed with skills in which I myself was lacking. I always took care to protect and also to further principles of practical spirituality in keeping with my guru's advice to me, be practical in your idealism. I contributed my own energy, often to the limit of my strength, while never forgetting that we are all only small cogs on life's very large wheel. Community leadership requires team effort. Success is not a one-man show. I tried, therefore, to channel energy and inspiration through others in cooperation with them, and never stood over them as the manager, nor intruded on their free will. Instead, I tried to win them by kindly reason and by my own sincere commitment to truth, no matter who utters it. At this point in my story, then, practicing as ever the principle of delegating authority, I leave to my companions in our 34-year odyssey the task of telling what remains, which is the bulk indeed of this saga. Each of them will tell it differently and will give his or her perspective, and so they ought to do, for it is their story and Ananda's quite as much as it is my own. The story will be the richer because I didn't write all of it myself. There are a few points I'd like to make here at the end of my account, a few final hammer taps, so to speak, to make sure the nails are set as tightly as possible. One of those nails is a question that several readers, I suspect, will have asked. Is it necessary for a community like Ananda to be spiritual? Much thought has been devoted in modern times to find solutions that depend entirely on human effort without God, and without even such high ideals as love, happiness, and voluntary as opposed to enforced cooperation. I've written unabashedly of my own ideal to live wholeheartedly for God. I fully realize that to say so is frowned upon in today's society. Even granting that Ananda has worked well, is there a hope that a more, quote, normal community can succeed? No, frankly, I see no such hope. The reason is perfectly simple. A so-called normal life is not really normal at all. It is abnormal. If people live selfishly, what hope have they of clambering out of their habit-worn mental ruts? Attempts have been made, and the results always have been disappointing. I hope you won't mind if I have a little fun here. I have a counter-question to offer. Is it necessary for a community to be alive? Is it necessary for a body to have a head, and for that head to hold brains? Is it necessary for human beings to be conscious? Modern communist philosophy exalts muscle over brain and the proletariat over a so-called aristocratic elite. In effect, what it encourages is stupidity with the purpose of gaining mass control by a false elite of self-centered, cloddish bullies. Taramata's concept of crowd management was essentially no different from that of Marx, Engels, and Lenin. Cooperative communities can succeed only if greater and not less awareness is encouraged. The concept of God symbolizes, if nothing else, the need of every human being to aspire to the highest potential he can imagine for himself. What do people think it means to be spiritual? Do they imagine it to be a matter of telling long strings of beads and mumbling incessant prayers? What kind of tasteless pudding do they think the masters have invited mankind to ingest? Do people want ideals without challenges, or safe platitudes that merely fall flat like an eggless souffle, the wisdom sucked out of them for fear of giving offense? Do they want popular acclaim without integrity, and principles so bland that no one even notices they exist? If you want to people such a wasteland with cactuses, go to your Nietzsches, your Sartres, your biologists who claim life is meaningless because they've worked out a handful of mere evolutionary mechanisms. An intentional community with no higher goal than economic security is not what I've proposed in these pages. Nor is it what I have struggled, suffered, and even risked my life to achieve. My dream at the age of 15 remains unchanged after 60 years. I am no longer young, but in spirit I am younger than ever, secure in a way that I see leads to inner freedom, happiness, inspiration, and the richest possible sense of meaning. If your own quest is for something else, then ignore this book. Warn your friends not to read it. Pretended solutions, however, that skirt the question of spirituality are sodas without the fizz, lemonades without the lemon, books without a light for reading them. Yes, I believe that if a community would find meaning in life and not a sleeping pill slugged down with a glass of water, people have no choice but to be spiritual. The only thing I concede, in fact insist upon, is that spirituality not be lumped with religiosity. Man is a spiritual being, of this I am certain. If he rejects the higher reality of his being, which would inspire him to highest achievements, he is a walking, eating corpse, incapable of bringing life to this planet, and able only to procreate other corpses like himself. One of the most important aspects of Ananda, and a fitting note on which to close this book, is music. I have noticed, as have many Ananda members, that those who have become involved in our music, played it, sung it in our choirs, listened to it at home and at work, have understood in their hearts what Ananda is all about. To convey this understanding by words alone would be impossible. Man consists essentially of sound vibrations condensed from the music of creation. Without music, life itself would cease to be. Communities can succeed only if every member seeks his own center, not in outer consensus, but in himself. It is from this center that he should reach out to touch others, from within, finally, and in attunement with the inner song of creation, comes the harmony that enables people to work together in a spirit of true harmony. Therefore, Yogananda said, seclusion is the price of greatness. We must listen to the voice of God in our souls. Inner communion with him will put us in touch with our conscience. To walk with others in lockstep togetherness is to become at last a mere lemming plunging to destruction because one has failed to develop awareness, lives oblivious to present realities, and ends in the gray oblivion of death. To stride through life in company with others, singing joyfully, is to become the hero or heroine that God has ever intended us to be. Afterward, it's strange that something I have puzzled over for 50 years should suddenly come clear to me now, simply because it was someone else who asked me the question. It has happened to me often, however. I've pondered something for years, but only when the same question was put to me by someone else that I suddenly know the solution. In this case, it was something my guru said to me at least twice and perhaps 3 times. After I am gone, the monks must live in separate colonies from the women renunciates. Later I discovered he had not said this to the women, who were in fact running things. Why, I asked myself, would he say something so important to the future of his work only to me? Granted, I was in charge of the monks, but my responsibility at the time spread no further than that. In later years, my concern for finding a separate piece of property on Mount Washington was even turned against me by Mrinalini Mata, who wrote the other directors in support of my ouster from SRF. I always felt that Kriyananda's desire to find a separate property was because he wanted to get the monks out from under Dayamata's control. Why did Master tell me, but not Dayamata? My puzzlement regarding Master's words was increased by the fact that Señor Cuarón, our center leader and representative in Mexico, told me once during a visit, Master said to me yesterday, I see you in a building down on the corner of the property on Mount Washington. This was where San Rafael Avenue meets Rome Drive. Here, in later years, the monk's ashram was constructed. Why, I asked myself, had Master insisted to me so strongly that the monks must live altogether separately from the women, then not tell anyone else, especially the women in charge, that this was his wish? And why would he then tell Mr. Cuarón he saw him in another building on the Mount Washington property, a building which he must have known would be the monk's ashram? A friend recently put this question to me, motivating me to put it to Master in meditation. Instantly the answer came, because I wanted you to think of yourself as working separately from the women directors. You could never have done the work you have done except independently of them. One naturally wonders why he didn't simply come out and tell me so. It was necessary, however, that the karmic pattern follow its own course. I often found in his guidance that he gave only subtle hints of his deeper meaning. My service to him would not have worked out as it did had I known his intentions from the start. I am grateful, though, for what he did state clearly at the time. I might have lacked the courage to think as independently as I did had it not been for those words of his to me.